At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
I'm Kyle Rizdahl, and this is a Marketplace special podcast, The Breakdown, what's working in the jobs market. We gained 100,000 new jobs last month. It's nice, but it's not near enough. So this hour, a ride across the economy by bus to see how people are getting by.
Do I live check to check? Yeah, I do.
How long's it been like that?
Since I had my kids, since I started working.
16 years it's been like that.
Pretty much.
Check to check.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you tired?
I'm tired.
Elsewhere, though, plenty of energy.
I had several friends, computer science majors in particular, they were getting offered $35 an hour as summer interns before they even have their bachelor's degree.
Not into computers? No problem.
So the best thing I can do is to just be multifaceted and multifunctional and just find a way through that.
You seem remarkably positive.
Thank you.
Tales from the number two bus, signs of life in North Dakota and Detroit, and writers on work coming up on The Breakdown, a Marketplace special podcast from APM, American Public Media. This is a Marketplace special report, The Breakdown. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. Coming up today, what's working in the job market? And for now, at least, the job market itself does seem to be working. We added 103,000 jobs in September, better than many dared hope for, way better than the flatline we saw in August. But hope doesn't get you an economic recovery. So this hour, how people are coping with the uncertainty, how they're making it work without having work, and what it's like waiting for that moment when the economy is going to turn around. First, though, a look at the latest numbers from somebody who used to crunch them for the government. Betsy Stevenson is a former chief economist at the Labor Department. Betsy, good to have you with us.
My pleasure. It's good to talk to you today.
So what's your gut on the numbers for September?
Well, you know, what I see is something that we've been seeing for several months now, which is job growth that is growth, but treading water growth. Not enough to bring the unemployment rate down, but enough to sort of just barely keep up with growth in the labor force.
Yeah, so what does that mean, though?
Well, what that means is we need to be adding more jobs in order to get the unemployment rate down. And now, if you look at what we saw this month, we saw 103,000 jobs added, but we actually saw 137,000 jobs added by the private sector. For every four jobs the private sector's adding, government's taking one away. So private sector's having to do a bit more extra heavy lifting to give us jobs because we're losing, you know, just bleeding so many government jobs.
Well, that sort of gets to the chicken and the egg thing, right? It's what's going to come first, jobs coming back or consumers feeling confident enough to spend and get businesses investing in creating those jobs?
You're exactly right to point to this confidence problem. And what I saw last month when we looked at the numbers for August was businesses and consumers paralyzed in fear over the debt negotiations. The zero job number we saw last month, frankly, reflected what we deserved given the way Congress behaved fighting over the debt ceiling.
That's a little rough, but okay.
I mean, people said, if you're not going to do anything, we're not going to do anything. When Congress forces businesses out of fear to stop and say, hey, I can't do anything until you tell me what the environment's going to be like, they stop hiring and they wait and see.
Well, let me take you sideways a little bit then and ask you to comment on my developing theory that the economy we have today is the economy we're going to have on Election Day, that in the next 14 months, nothing's going to happen to change that.
I'm a little bit afraid that that might be right.
Yeah.
It's not a crisis, right? Adding 103,000 jobs, that kind of job growth, unemployment's not going to go up, but it's not going to go down. My fear is people don't feel like it's an emergency. We need people running around like their hair was on fire because unemployment's so high. But unfortunately, people seem to have gotten in their head, oh, this is the new normal, 9% unemployment. It's not getting worse. And it, frankly, we need people to start behaving like it's an emergency.
What are the bright spots? There must be some.
The bright spots are that the growth we do have is broad-based. If you look across the jobs report, we added jobs almost everywhere, and I want to see more of that. I want to see more broad-based growth.
Why does it feel so much worse now, though? Right? Because it just feels there's just this sensibility that it's just ugly and bad.
We have a large number of people who haven't worked in more than 6 months. And that's a culture of unemployment the United States has never had before. People who haven't worked in so long that they're not sure what they can do, should do to get back to work. It's really a sea change for the United States, which has been for so many decades an economy characterized by its dynamic labor market. People change jobs, they start new jobs, they leave jobs. That dynamism of the U.S. labor market is what's made it so terrific. And what we're seeing now is that it's not just the people who don't have jobs, but the ones who do have jobs are afraid to leave. So everybody's a little bit stuck.
So right about here, when I do a jobs interview, and obviously we do a lot of them on this show, the economist in question will say something like, but America has an innovative economy. I believe in the power of this economy to bounce back, and we've done it before, and we will do it again. Are you going to tell me that, or are you not going to tell me that?
Mom, I'm a little bit more frightened, I think, than I normally would be. I mean, I think all those things are true, but we do have a lot of uncertainty out there, and we have a lot of people who are feeling paralyzed. Nobody knows for sure what we can do to add more jobs. And people who think they know for sure, I just don't think are telling the truth. And we need more open-mindedness, and we need more people working together as a community to try to solve the worst employment crisis we're going to see in my lifetime.
Betsy Stevenson used to be the chief economist at the Department of Labor. She's on the visiting faculty at Princeton University at the moment. Betsy, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's great talking with you, Kai.
If you're wondering where your state ranks in the national unemployment picture, go to our website. Check out our interactive map. Compare, contrast, crunch the numbers. It's marketplace.org.
The Breakdown. What's working in the job market is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam, a world of investing.
We talk a lot about the monthly jobs numbers, like it's an abstract thing, like it has no meaning in and of itself, which kind of misses the basic point about unemployment in this country. These are real people out there looking for work. So we're going to meet some of them this hour on their way to work, on the morning bus commute, to get a picture of what it means to have work or not to have.
So here we are, beginning of Sunset Boulevard. Runs 26 miles that way. That way is west, by the way.
That's the way we're headed, too, on the Sunset bus line, starting downtown. The number 2 bus travels through the working class neighborhoods of the East Side, out into Hollywood, the economic engine of Los Angeles, down through Beverly Hills, on into UCLA, all the way to the beach on the Pacific Ocean. We wanted to get not so much a snapshot, really, more of a slice of the changing economy. A look at what's working and what needs to work better so that more people can work. Sunset and Figueroa, downtown Los Angeles. It's where we're catching the number 2 today, along with a couple of other people.
Hi, my name's Eddie Lozama.
How old are you, Eddie?
18 years old.
What do you ride the bus for?
I live at Sunset and Echo Park, and yeah. I come to school here, so...
Dude, it's 9:10 in the morning. You're going home, you're done already?
Yeah, I go for an hour and then just go home, eat, and then come back.
Eddie's a skinny kid. Maybe he needs that extra meal. I don't know. But he's been thinking a lot about the economy and what he's going to do when high school's over.
Are you worried about being able to get a job? I mean, obviously, you're thinking about all the school stuff,
actually,
right?
Yeah, I am worried about getting a job because it's pretty hard out there.
Let me ask you something. You're 18 years old?
Yeah, I'm 18 years old.
And you're already worried about finding a job?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems a little harsh, man. When you're 18, you should be just having fun and learning how to grow up.
Yeah, but, you know, it's also that when you turn 18 nowadays, it's like I have to have a job, you know. With my parents, I can't have my parents supporting me, you know.
What do your parents have to say about this?
Get a job.
Headed west out of downtown, these are working-class neighborhoods. Dollar stores and fast food joints line the streets. People like Eddie's parents live right here.
Approaching Sunset and Echo Park.
So you look out the window, and what do you see? You see Blessed Sacrament School, dentists and cleaners and Pizza Huts. Darling Sienes lives here, too. She climbs aboard the bus in Echo Park, just west of downtown. Breakfast is still in her hands. It's a quick bite and a big cup of coffee from McDonald's.
What do you do?
I'm an administrative assistant for UCLA.
Oh, excellent. So obviously you're riding the bus all the way out there.
I do.
That's 15 miles out Sunset to campus, 2 hours each way, every day, for $36,000 a year. She's a single mom, two teenagers.
Do I live check to check? Yeah, I do.
How long has it been like that?
Since I had my kids, since I started working.
16 years it's been like that.
Pretty much.
Check to check.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you tired?
I'm tired. I want to go back to school. I want to make more money, but just not possible right now. Yeah.
She wants to get ahead. She wants to get a better job.
There are some times that I get super frustrated. I get pissed off. There's periods where I'm like that, you know, but then I just, all right, well, this is what it is, and I just have to make the best of it and just keep going.
Roro's Chicken, Headshot Image, Photo Lab, Hollywood Handbags Plus. Down the road a bit, maybe a couple of miles out of downtown, a woman named Alex climbs aboard.
Mind if I ask how old you are?
How old do I look?
You look like you're 27.
Okay, I'm 39.
See, you look really good. come on, I'm no dope, right?
She looks busy, tapping away at her BlackBerry, shooting off some morning emails, I guess. But work's been hard to come by.
What do you do?
Singer-songwriter.
So how's business?
Slow. Very slow.
So how are you getting by?
Unemployment. Any gig that I can round up whenever I can, take it. These are the slow times, so if you can get one once a month, it's great.
And you can't get by on one.
You really
one gig a
can't.
Month.
You really can't. And unemployment isn't enough to get by really either. So, you know, it's tough.
So now imagine 14 million more people. Let me say that again. 14 million people out of work. Sometimes for years. Every single one of them wondering when help's going to arrive. Wondering when this crisis is going to turn around.
We were supposed to rely on each other, but people haven't been very forthcoming with helping each other, and that's where we're failing each other. You know,
it's last question. Truly, I don't want to make you miss your stop, but that's what happens in these times, right? People get worried about themselves.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, I think if people learn to hold on and be true, you know, to themselves and really hang in there, we can make it through it.
Metro staff, please.
We heard that over and over again on the number two bus. Getting by, making it through, glimmers of hope. And it turns out all those positive attitudes, not totally misplaced. More on that in a little bit when we stop off in Hollywood. It's a long slog across L.A. on the bus, so you tend to see a lot of writers cracking open a book to pass the time. And as it happens, a lot of writers are thinking about regular folks and the economy when they put pen to paper. So we're going to hear from some of those writers this hour, starting with Pulitzer Prize winner Jeffrey Eugenides.
Recently, I've been writing about young people graduating into the recession of 1982. So I've been thinking about unemployment, especially unemployment when you're young, and how daunting that can be. I actually don't agree with some of the most dire assessments. I don't really agree that it's going to hold down people's income for the rest of their lives. Every day I'm hearing these terrible prognostications scaring the living daylight out of young people now. And, you know, it does get better. You can graduate into the middle of a recession and survive. I have a little bit of optimism because I can see it in my rearview mirror a bit, and I know that we'll get through it.
Novelist Jeffrey Eugenides. His brand new book is called The Marriage Plot. The subplot of the jobs market is that one good job creates another.
The way to think of Hollywood in Los Angeles County is first as the industry itself, which is 250,000 jobs. But that's not counting the tourism business, the food and drink establishments.
Glitz, glamour, and getting by. That's coming up on The Breakdown. What's working in the job market? A marketplace special from APM, American Public Media.
This is Marketplace, a special report, The Breakdown. What's working in the job market? I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us. We're on the number two bus in Los Angeles today, traveling across town on Sunset Boulevard to try to figure out how people are getting by. In Hollywood now, the bus stops pretty often to pick up new riders, people trying to get to work if they're lucky enough to have it. We're headed west.
Hollywood Center Motel, where the neon is clearly broken. Oh my God, it looks like Norman Bates' house. That's horrifying.
Maxwell Fleming hops on the bus on a stretch of Sunset that runs through an area called Silver Lake. He's a young guy, 30-ish, burly with a big bushy beard and a resume not uncommon in this neighborhood. Hipsters and artists, mostly.
What do you do?
I'm a writer and an illustrator.
Tell me more.
Well, right now I'm trying to illustrate children's books. And I write articles for a online website, and I'm working on a screenplay.
So it seems like this is a great example of what a lot of economists call the gig economy. You're moving from gig to gig to gig.
Yeah, the ultimate freelance journey. But as soon as I get burnt out in the rat race, I'm going to pack up my luggage and move on.
Stop requested. Please use rear exit.
The number two bus, with us on it, pulls up to Sunset and Vine, practically the heart of Hollywood. The town. That is, but Hollywood, the industry, is global, like so many other industries, and like so many of the economic problems facing the world.
Amoeba Music, CNN, the Arclight Theater, Kim Kardashian on the billboard, advertising Midori. Go figure that out. Can I have a big glass of iced tea? That'd be great. Thanks a lot. So here's what we did. It's lunchtime. We're hungry. We got off the bus. We're at the Waffle in Hollywood, right on Sunset, to talk about Hollywood.
Economist John Blank works for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. He says the entertainment industry is doing all right, but for the rest of the world, it means more movies and more television. Here, it means jobs.
How much does the county of Los Angeles rely on Hollywood? I mean, people think L.A. and they think, oh, Hollywood.
The way to think of Hollywood in Los Angeles County is first as the industry itself, which is a quarter of a million jobs. But that's not counting the tourism business, the food and drink establishments, all of these other industries, the TV industry, right? And that's why it's very hard to understate the value that industry has to this area.
So it generates jobs in and of itself.
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. Hollywood is basically growing with the growth of the world economy, not with the growth of the U.S. economy.
Let me see if I can play this out a little bit. We've got people in developing economies getting more disposable income, who can shell out $3, $4, $5, $6, $7, $8 American equivalent to go see our exports, to go see our own domestic product.
Yeah, I mean, what that means is you know, you're seeing them being able to leverage the growth outside the country in incomes and in population that's interested in movies. So it's one of our biggest exports.
Hollywood has been making a transition, right? They've been able to figure out how to get those other economies to buy our product. Is the rest of Los Angeles County making that transition to a different kind of economy as well?
Most of Los Angeles has transitioned fairly well. I mean, the thing that you see here, though, is also Los Angeles County has suffered from globalization. If you look at manufacturing, and that's 250,000 jobs lost in Los Angeles County alone, that is just a number of points of unemployment just in that alone.
Okay, so now what?
I'm working on an apparel industry. There's this company called Rhapsody in Korea. They make Korean-sourced and manufactured apparel in Korea. But now they want to get made-in-California apparel shipped to Korea. So there you see that there could come jobs back in Los Angeles and restore that part of the economy. That's the rosy scenario.
The best-case scenario, something that could put people back to work in the future, turn the sinking economy around. But when? And just how many jobs are there going to be? It's hard to say, which means tough times now for blue-collar workers.
It's 4.5% unemployment for college-educated people. It's 16% unemployment if you do not have access to a college education. No education, no writing skills, no math skills, no presentation skills, no ability to do any of the salaried jobs that are in the service economy.
So what is somebody who's out there looking for a job to think?
What they're going to have to do if they're looking for a job is think of it as like a popcorn popper that's constantly throwing off popcorn. If you come and hit the market over and over again, you're going to find different kernels of corn in that popcorn. And that's what you got to think about. You got to keep at it, and you got to keep looking for the next new thing, even if it wasn't in the place you last looked.
keep at it. Or maybe if you have the means, if you can find the access, go out and get those writing skills, get the math skills, get an education. Down the road a couple of miles, right on the Sunset Bus Line. That's what thousands of wannabe workers are doing right now at UCLA.
I've mostly been thinking about the ways that technology is changing the job market, the ways that companies are choosing to replace human workers with machines. What we've noticed is that as companies lay people off, their businesses sort of improve. They notice that they can be a lot more productive with the workers that they have. They don't have to hire new people, and they can sort of replace some of the functions with machines, with automation. I've looked at sort of industries where people have used automated robots, sort of physical robots to do this, but there's a lot of kind of servers that can step in for people to, you know, do a lot of calculations that you might have had an accountant do, or to diagnose specimens that you might have had a doctor do. This is sort of happening across the economy in many different industries that you wouldn't expect.
Farhad Manju writes about technology for Slate. You want to see the cutting edge of technology in this country, you pretty much have to go to Silicon Valley. Valley's actually a misnomer when you think about it, because the tech community there stretches from north of San Francisco, 50, maybe 60 miles south, down to San Jose. There are wealthy venture capitalists up in the hills, entrepreneurs down below grinding it out, and plenty of places in between that are getting left behind. Marketplace's Steve Henn takes a tour of that economic landscape.
Last month, Sean Parker threw a party in San Francisco. You may remember Parker. As a kid, he helped create Napster. He was the bad boy in the movie The Social Network, and his stake in Facebook made him a billionaire. The party was for Spotify, a streaming music service he has a piece of, and it was pretty fabulous. There were whole roast pigs turning on spits. The indie band The Killers played, and Parker chartered jets from L.A. and New York to bring in the beautiful people. By the middle of the night, Snoop Dogg was hanging with Facebook founder and boy billionaire Mark Zuckerberg. The wealth being created in Silicon Valley these days is almost mind-blowing. And for the programmers and engineers who keep the money machine running, the recovery is well underway.
Just from here to San Francisco, there's four billboards saying we're hiring. So Groupon, Twitter, Facebook, Zynga, everybody's fighting for talent.
Gary Swart is the CEO of Odesk. He helps tech firms hire employees from all over the world. They work remotely. It's one way to avoid bidding wars for software programmers. Rodham Perlmutter runs a recruiting website called Top Prospect. He says the market for tech talent is tight.
I think it's never been tighter. I was here in the late 90s, and it was hard to find people then, and I'd say it's at least as hard today.
His site will pay a finder's fee of up to $20,000 if you recommend a Facebook friend who lands a job Perlmutter's trying to fill. In just 2 days last week, he cut five checks and sent tens of thousands of dollars out the door. So for the objects of the tech industry's affection, life on the leafy streets of Palo Alto has never been better. But for non-techies, not so much.
My name is Claudia Warren. I am a mom of two girls that are college age.
Claudia and her family live in a little town called Millbrae. Like many small towns here, it's expensive. Nice homes, good schools. Claudia and her husband stretched to afford it, and now they're in trouble.
I've been unemployed for a year and a month. And the business that I worked in prior, I was there for 15 and a half years. 15 and a half years, that's a long time to be somewhere.
Claudia was a buyer at a baby store that went under. Her husband has a good job, but her paycheck mattered. And with no college degree, she can't find work.
Scary. Money ran out. It's tough.
Warren's daughter quit her traveling softball team to save money, and she's joining the Army Reserves to pay for college. There are lots of families like the Warrens here. People living in the shadow of a job boom they're not part of. In fact, the unemployment rate in the heart of Silicon Valley is still higher than the national average. Even in the wealthiest enclaves, some families are quietly struggling. I know middle-aged engineers in Palo Alto, guys with impressive degrees who have been looking for work for 2 years. But all these young companies prefer young engineers with the latest skills. And just across a bridge from Palo Alto, on the other side of Highway 101, things are much worse. The border of East Palo Alto is probably less than a mile from Mark Zuckerberg's new house. But it's a different world. There are fewer trees, empty lots are strung with razor wire. Officially, the unemployment rate is 20%. Carlos Romero is the mayor.
We do provide a lot of service sector workers to Silicon Valley, whether it's in the hotels, whether it's domestics, whether it's folks working in the restaurants, whether it's the construction industry. And all of those areas took a downturn.
Romero says when the recession hit, his city was still reeling from the last downturn, which destroyed thousands of good blue-collar jobs. The city built big box stores and a fancy hotel for tech executives to try and fill the gap. It helped, but it wasn't enough.
A lot of the manufacturing has moved out. And so folks who were from East Palo Alto who might be able to kind of meet the educational requirements for those manufacturing jobs no longer have the ability to get into those jobs because they don't exist.
The jobs being created, and there are thousands of them, are mostly in high tech. But many guys from here, guys like Marquis Solomon, can't get them.
The people that actually end up in those types of jobs, wow, that's, I've never really just seen them walk in the street. They're not the people that you see. The people that you see are the people that are unemployed.
Solomon's been out of work for 4 years. He lives in a depressed section of East Menlo Park, just around the corner from where Facebook's building its new headquarters. But that probably won't help him. Again, Mayor Romero.
I mean, this is really a knowledge-based society at this point. And really, a big part of our problem is dealing with folks who have, you know, we have probably a 30, possibly 35% dropout rate in high schools.
Here's the thing. Some of the best public schools in California, some of the most lavishly funded public schools in the country, are located just a few miles away.
I don't know anywhere in the country where there's this stark of a change between sort of the haves and the have-nots.
Peter Fortenbaugh is president of the local Boys and Girls Club.
So basically, the kids who need the most, who are the most behind, get the least resources. And it just continues to get more extreme in our community.
Fortenbaugh says most of these kids simply are not being prepared for the kinds of jobs Silicon Valley is creating. In a globally competitive market, unless something changes, he says they won't stand a chance. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There are plenty of cities where you find bidding wars for workers in the most sought-after professions and lackluster hiring for careers that aren't really helping the economy. It's kind of the way supply and demand is supposed to work, even with people. But it does contribute to one of the universal truths of this recession. Consumers just aren't spending, which is a problem because one of the ways a recovery is going to start is when consumers have more confidence to spend. So in this next story, we're going to introduce you to consumers with a whole lot of confidence in a city that's better known for the most depressing jobless numbers around, Detroit, Michigan. Gregory Warner reports now from our health desk at WHYY.
How'd you do?
I think I did okay.
67 students are recovering from their last final of the day at the Oakland University School of Nursing in Detroit. Kara Thoit, one of the students, tells me that hers is the new face of Detroit.
Everyone and their brother are going, they're in school to be a nurse right now. I mean, everybody knows at least five people, I swear.
Everybody around here is nodding, so I guess it's everybody's experience.
Yeah.
This is a special accelerated program that attracts students from other careers. Lawyers, airline pilots, some automotive engineers. Kara Thoit herself worked in school administration. So why is it that so many workers in the City of Champions are turning to healthcare?
The money and the demand, you know, there's always going to be a job somewhere.
This program has a job placement rate of 100%. Every graduate has gotten a job. And that would be reason for celebration in any city. But in Detroit, with 16% unemployment, it sounds like a cry of redemption.
Healthcare is going to be one of those key areas aiding the city of Detroit to turn around.
John King is consultant to the Detroit Workforce Development Board. It oversees $60 million in federal funds for job training programs.
And that includes training for lots and lots and lots of healthcare workers.
And that makes healthcare workers very confident. And when people feel like they're part of a boom, they spend like it. Jeff Axt owns one of the city's largest women's clothing stores, Bizarre Collection. That's spelled B-I-Z-R.
Definitely color is
what we're known for here at Bazaar. So if the department store has it in black and brown, we'll have it in yellow, white, lilac, and mint.
He's talking there about shoes, by the way. Axe says that healthcare workers are often his best customers. Call it the Bazaar Confidence Index. He's noticed that healthcare workers are often even more confident consumers than people in other jobs, like auto workers and school teachers.
But you see it on the ground in the healthcare industry when you're like a neighbor of a healthcare provider.
Or you see it if you're selling them shoes.
And if you're seeing them selling them shoes, if they're booked to the hill on their clinic for the next 6 months, you have a lot different psychology than if you're worried about them shutting down your assembly line.
Shutting down your assembly line or firing workers, in part to pay for skyrocketing health costs. And this irony hasn't been lost on business owners. They have mixed feelings about whether or not this federal money to train healthcare workers is a good thing when healthcare expansion drives up the cost of care. Doug Rothwell is president and CEO of Business Leaders from Michigan.
We are concerned about, for example, you know, how many medical schools do we need in the state? How many state-of-the-art technology centers? Those all add to costs. On the other hand, we do recognize that it is driving some, you know, net wealth creation.
And small businesses are cropping up to get a piece of that wealth. It's around the hospitals and the university that you find the organic food stores, the pet sitter shop and art gallery. None of this was here 5 years ago. And as opposed to the auto industry, healthcare's workforce is younger, more diverse, more female, and maybe more likely to flaunt their success. At least that could explain the healthy sales of Bazaar's flashy, crystal-encrusted cowboy boots.
The leather is distressed and cracked, and then it has Swarovski crystal rhinestones in an eagle pattern up front and up the shaft. It's a $1,500 Western boot, and we sell it 12 months a year.
And that's consumer confidence. In Detroit, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
New healthcare jobs are helping lower the overall unemployment rate in Michigan. You can see how your state stacks up with our interactive map, America at Work, it's called. It's at marketplace.org.
I go about writing about work by looking at the hearts and desires of the people who are attempting to fulfill their own dreams for themselves, but then also of taking care of their families. And so I view it as a people-centered way of understanding perhaps the economy and of whatever crisis we're in. And I spent 15 years and interviewed over 1,200 people who had survived the Great Depression. And so I tend to take the long view when it comes to how people survive. And it's given me a sense of confidence in the ability of people to remake themselves and to adjust and find ways to survive the worst of times. And I think there's a lot that can be learned from that.
Isabel Wilkerson's latest book is called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Coming up, there aren't enough jobs to go around for the workers we have, so college kids?
I don't think that people in the 18 to 22 age bracket are cognizant of what's going on at all. No one seems to care. They're young yet, you know. They still have their parents' credit cards.
Rude Awakenings. That's next on The Breakdown, a Marketplace special, What's Working in the Jobs Market. It's from APM. American Public Media. This is Marketplace, a special report, The Breakdown, What's Working in the Jobs Market. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. Today, we're taking a ride out along Sunset Boulevard, talking to people about jobs and about the economy. So on the number 2 bus, cruising out of Hollywood, there is an abrupt change in scenery. One minute you've got the Sunset Strip. It's the Laugh Factory, the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Viper Room. And then it's lush green lawns. All of a sudden, mansions. It's Beverly Hills. Not that Boris Dralyuk would notice. He's got his nose planted firmly in a book. It looks like it's something written in Russian.
What do you do for a living?
I teach at UCLA.
What do you teach?
I teach Russian language and literature.
He teaches undergrads the finer points of Tolstoy for about $30,000 a year. Do you get by on that?
Yeah, I do. Personally, that's enough. I'm a small man.
Yeah, but Russians live large. I mean, we know
that. Yeah, that's the vodka.
That's the
vodka,
right.
Expenditures
the vodka alone.
I know.
Yeah, yeah. So he gets by, but those kids he's teaching? Do you say to them, why are you guys wasting your time in a Russian language and literature course?
Well, I think that at that undergraduate level, they're not wasting their time. If they choose to pursue it at the graduate level, then maybe it's time to consider other options.
Not a lot of jobs out there for Russian lit experts. And Dralyuk worries not enough students are thinking that way.
I don't think that people in the 18 to 22 age bracket are cognizant of what's going on at all. No one seems to care. They're young yet, you know. They still have their parents' credit cards.
Stop requested. Please use rear exit. Approaching Hilgard and Whiten.
So here we are, corner of what? Hilgard and Westholm. There's the Gamma Phi Beta house over there. UCLA sweatshirts everywhere. Today, the first day of school. It's the first full week of classes, at UCLA anyway. And a couple of blocks onto campus, there's that, please, freshmen, join our club thing going on. There's Lambda Theta Nu, Chinese Students Association at UCLA. Bruin Harmony, whatever that is. Just the first week of school, but English major Karen McDonough's already thinking about what's next.
I'm 21, senior at UCLA.
And you're graduating?
Yes.
So you're screwed.
Absolutely.
There's always been a balance between doing what's practical and following your dream. But in a state with 12% unemployment, maybe the scales ought to be tipped a bit toward the practical. So 3.5 years ago when you started at UCLA, what were you thinking?
I mean, I feel like they kind of counsel you into do what you like, do what you love. If you enjoy it, you're going to be good at it. And so I just picked English and then later on realized that maybe that wasn't the best choice.
So would you basically take any job?
Yes, I would. Absolutely.
Give us your name, would you?
Lindsay Sharp.
Lindsay Sharp, also a senior, also looking for a job. Not as nervous, though, as our English major, because she's an engineer.
I don't face the same degree of uncertainty as a lot of my peers do.
Do you feel bad that you're basically, you've got a plan and everybody else is, ah?
It can be interesting at times, but I had several friends, computer science majors in particular, they were getting offered $35 an hour as summer interns before they even have their bachelor's degree.
If you didn't choose the right plan the first time, Russian lit, anybody? Maybe it's time to switch gears. Not us, though. We continue down the Sunset Line and reach our final destination, coming up.
One thing a novelist can do is reflect what's going on. And in my neighborhood, I keep seeing what I think are yard sales until I get close and realize they're evictions. And that's the sort of detail that sparks a novelist's mind and sends them back to the keyboard. I do think it's a really difficult and tragic time, and as a novelist, you know, you're drawn to those kinds of stories because of their inherent drama, but also their importance. I feel like after this jobless recovery or whatever it's called, I really think that there are people dealing with this at a level that I don't think we've seen in books or movies or television. I think the fine edge of poverty is a lot sharper than we're imagining right now.
Jess Walter is the author of the book, The Financial Lives of Poets. We had him on a couple of years ago when that came out. All right, now imagine if you can, a place where the labor market's humming right along, where the unemployment rate is around 3%, where if you want a job, you can have a job. Where, truth be told, companies are desperately trying to find people to work. Such a place does exist, you know. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to find the secrets of North Dakota's success.
You can tell the second you get there. North Dakota is not like other places. Actually, you can tell before you get there. Flights are really expensive, like whisking off to Paris expensive. And if you can find a hotel room, make that a motel room, it can run as high as $600 a night. Roads and highways are choked with semis. There are "We're hiring" signs everywhere. And you hear a lot of this.
Your Williston Walmart Supercenter is hiring now. Positions are currently available for cashiers, unloaders, tire and lube express.
Williston is in the remote northwestern corner of North Dakota. Not a lot out there. The Badlands, rolling waves of grain, and, oh yeah, one of the largest oil resources on the planet, which is pretty much what's behind all this madness.
It took a combination of two 21st century technologies, hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling.
Lynn Helms directs North Dakota's Department of Mineral Resources. He says the oil is 2 miles down and locked inside rock. To get it, they use fracking, fracturing the rock and then pushing water through the cracks to extract the oil. They figured out how to apply the technique in North Dakota about 5 years ago.
That changed our largest resource that contains around 400 billion barrels of oil into an economically producible resource for the state.
Oil companies raced to North Dakota, and suddenly Helms went from processing about one oil drilling permit per week to about 20 per day. And every one of those permits means jobs. In the last few years, North Dakota has added 35,000 oil jobs. The state's entire population is only 630,000, which is why, pretty much overnight, North Dakota found itself dealing with a massive labor shortage. One Halliburton executive even went on Jim Cramer's Mad Money show on CNBC and begged workers to come.
You got a high school education. You can come to work for this organization. If that job will pay $125,000, $130,000 a year.
Now, wait a second. You're talking about an unskilled job that could conceivably pay
North Dakota's governor has also done his part.
I say, this is Governor Jack Dalrymple. Would you please come to North Dakota? We have 15,000 job openings in every field imaginable.
Governor Dalrymple is living out an economic fantasy most governors can only dream about. North Dakota's tax base is so big, there's money to bolster education and offer incentives to businesses, like property tax exemptions and low rates for workers' comp and unemployment insurance. That's helped attract a Caterpillar manufacturing plant, which will create 250 jobs in Fargo. Amazon's expanding its operation in Grand Forks, which will mean 200 customer service jobs.
North Dakota's probably the biggest industrial project going on in the United States of America right now.
Jim Arthod runs Missouri Basin Trucking in Belfield, North Dakota. Standing in his bustling industrial garage, Arthod says finding workers is a huge challenge and expense. His company spends $10,000 to $12,000 for every new worker he recruits.
We've been to probably half the states on job fairs. It's a full-time job for our human resource team.
Shannon Walker's husband went to one of those job fairs in Michigan and landed a position as an oil truck driver. Shannon got snapped up to work a desk job.
In Michigan, people are on unemployment for 99 weeks at a time because it's so hard to find a job. I was looking for 2.5 years before we came out here. It's wonderful.
If you lose your job here, just walk a block down the road and get another job, you know.
Yeah, you heard that right.
If you lose your job here, just walk a block down the road and get another job, you know.
That's Bob Ripka. He works in the oil fields in Williston. He came to North Dakota a few months ago from Minnesota.
I'd say 3/4 of my crew are from Minnesota. And there's a lot of people from Denver. The last three people I met the other day, they're all from Utah, so now they're moving in, you know.
And they all need somewhere to live and eat and shop, which has created a massive construction boom. Lynn Helms with the Department of Mineral Resources lived in Williston for years. Williston used to build about 5 new homes a year. This year, Williston built 2,000 new homes. Next year, they're aiming for 4,000.
This is similar to the California Gold Rush.
Sean Wanko is the Workforce Development Coordinator for the city of Williston. He shows me dozens of ceremonial groundbreaking shovels stacked in the corner of the office. He says they used to make special shovels for every groundbreaking, but they've had to go generic because of all the projects.
We have a 700-acre industrial park, which they're actually turning ground on. We have a 300-acre housing complex to the west. We've got a 200-acre retail commercial subdivision, which they'll be breaking ground on shortly.
Wanko says the high-paying oil and construction work is making the labor shortage especially hard for lower-paying sectors.
Welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you?
One local McDonald's offers workers a $300 signing bonus. Another pays $15 an hour and is offering a 32-inch flat-screen TV to workers who help recruit. Now, all of this is great for North Dakota, but can this hiring boom be franchised to other states? Governor Jack Dalrymple says yes.
It is about an educated workforce, low taxation, a friendly regulatory climate.
And it doesn't hurt if your state happens to be sitting on 400 billion barrels of oil. In Williston, North Dakota, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
My family was originally blue collar. My father had been a miner, a copper miner in Butte, Montana, And I was raised to respect everybody's work. I hand it to my parents. They said, you know, whatever anybody's doing, they're scrubbing a floor, you've got to respect that. There's no question that the working class is much harder hit than white-collar people in this recession. Just if you looked over the last 3 years at who was being laid off, the real carnage has been among blue-collar workers and disproportionately among Black and Latino workers. In all this talk about how we need more jobs, 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 let us not forget that that's not going to do much good unless the jobs pay enough to live on.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Nickel and Dimed. So creating jobs is one thing. It's a big thing, but it's just one thing. Maybe more important is what comes with those jobs. Wages, first of all, and benefits. Because what kinds of jobs we're adding to the economy matters too. MIT economist Paul Osterman's most recent book is called Good Jobs, America: Making Work Better for Everyone. Paul Osterman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take a high-wage job and a low-wage job in this economy. And tell me what happens when we add one of each. I mean, can you track the effects?
So in a low-wage job, two things happen. One is that the person is having to spend all their income, right, because it's a low-wage job. And that stimulates the economy. So if we could increase those wages for people at the bottom, we would increase consumption, we'd increase demand, we'd stimulate the economy. And a high-wage job, a Silicon Valley job, $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year job, which are great jobs, if we put more money in those people's pockets, they're not going to spend much of it. And so the stimulus effect of improving job quality at the bottom of the labor market is much better than the stimulus effect of putting more money in the pocket of people who really don't need it.
Do we have to choose in this economy between quality jobs and quantity of jobs?
No, we do not. We have good evidence that if you pay people better, their productivity goes up. And so when productivity goes up, it justifies the higher wages.
Isn't any job, though, a good job?
Compared to starvation, right? Compared to starvation, any job is a good job. That's right. But that's not the world we want to live in.
And it plays out into the larger society, right? This issue of the middle class in this country.
I think that the middle class has taken it on the chin, right? Not only are those jobs under enormous pressure, but people who lose middle class jobs are falling down into this low-wage labor market. What we need to do is to create ladders to help people climb into those good middle-class jobs. Those are ladders that are based on training, on provision of skill, on improving our community colleges, on helping firms provide more training for their incumbent workforce. We need more of those ladders.
You know, there are companies out there who are cutting back on hours for people. They're cutting some benefits, but they are keeping people on the theory that some slice of employment is better than a portion of their staff having no slice of employment. Is there not something to be said for that?
Oh, I think that's admirable. But we need to help all companies have a more progressive human resource policy.
Explore that a little bit for me, would you? And help me understand how you can do that without it being government coming in telling companies what they have to do.
It would be completely inappropriate, I think, for government to come in and tell companies you can't lay people off. What you want to do, among other things, is to offer companies incentives. So, for example, through the unemployment insurance system, so someone can reduce their hours, but also receive a portion of their unemployment insurance benefit. The company can reduce its labor costs without having to fire people. But dictating to companies what they should do with respect to layoffs is a mistake.
I wonder if you and those who advocate policies similar to those that you favor despair at the politics of the American economy.
I don't despair. I mean, obviously, I'm discouraged. But keep in mind this, that in 2006, in six states, there were a referendum on whether or not to raise the state minimum wage. Among those states were relatively conservative states like Arizona and Florida. And in all six states, those referendum passed. I think the American people support employment standards, so I'm discouraged. I'm not happy, but I wouldn't say I despair.
Paul Osterman teaches at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. His most recent book is called Good Jobs, America: Making Work Better for Everyone. Mr. Osterman, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
In this economy, everything boils down to jobs. Who's got them? Who doesn't? Who's killing them? Who's creating them? That's why we're on the bus today, to find out who's doing what in Los Angeles, and to get a read on where the economy might be heading. We're headed now out past UCLA, on the Sunset Bus Line, through ritzy West Side neighborhoods like Westwood and Brentwood, Pacific Palisades. The people who live here are white-collar workers, a lot of them rich. Really rich, maybe not feeling the sting of the recession like some of the riders who caught the bus downtown. But one day, you're set. And then the next day, the bubble bursts.
Hello.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, by the way. I'm the host of the show.
Hi, I'm Eric Kelly.
Nice to see you, Eric. How are you? Eric Kelly was an architectural draftsman till the housing industry went bust. No building, no need for his drawings. So he went back to school.
You know, I've heard different stories. I've heard people say that architecture isn't going to pick up for 6-7 years, all the way up to 15 years.
Right.
So the best thing I can do is to just be multifaceted and multifunctional and just find a way through that.
You seem remarkably positive.
Thank you.
Eric Kelly and almost everybody else we talked to on the bus said that at some point, this rough patch just can't last forever.
You know, you have to maintain a positive state of mind. You really do. I mean, I was mostly raised by my grandparents, so I was always taught that things used to be much, much worse. So, you know, I haven't had to go to a soup kitchen yet. You know, I haven't had to sell too many things. So, I mean, it could be a lot worse. And the way I see it, it has to eventually get better.
Stop requested. Please use rear exit.
Glimmers of hope. Reasons to stay positive. People out there making it work, finding a way to get by. That's what you learn riding the 2 bus. The line and this hour end here, where Sunset Boulevard ends, actually at the beach in the Pacific Ocean out in Malibu. Where this job crisis ends? That's not quite so cut and dry. But the ocean's not a bad metaphor. It's hokey, but it's not bad. So here you go. There are jobs coming to this economy. The hard part is knowing just when that tide's going to turn. So that's The Breakdown, a Marketplace special. It was produced by Nancy Fargali, Julie Podokas, Betsy Streisand, Millie Jefferson, Brendan Willard, Ravi Karman, and Stephen Cologne. Our executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. You can hear the latest news of business, economics, personal finance, and technology on all the Marketplace programs. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks so much for listening. And this is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.